From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Actress Andra Day recently became the second Black woman to ever win a Golden Globe Award for her role as the legendary singer Billie Holiday in the new film, The United States vs. Billie Holiday. The film focuses on how Holiday was the earliest high-profile target of the U.S. war on drugs. While her music is widely loved, her personal story is little known and was told in a book by journalist Johan Hari that the film is based on. A few years ago, I spoke with Hari about his book, Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. By almost all accounts, the war on drugs has been a miserable failure. Aside from failing to address the causes of addiction, the war has disproportionately targeted poor people and people of color who fill up our absurdly large prisons. On the border with Mexico, it has unleashed a horribly violent war, empowering traffickers and armed militias. In his book about the U.S.'s war on drugs, Hari, who is a British journalist, explores the obscure historical origins of the drug war through the stories of ordinary people and a history that goes back to the 1930s with a man named Harry Anslinger and his vendetta against Billie Holiday. Today, we'll play for you my 2015 conversation with Johan Hari about his book Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs, on which the new film, The United States versus Billie Holiday, is based. So, Johan, what motivated you to approach this book? I understand you have your own experience with addiction. Is that what motivated you?
I think it was a few things. I knew that we were coming up to 100 years since drugs were first criminalized. And it's kind of mind-blowing to think that two global wars began in 1914. One is the one that we've been commemorating. You know, the other one hasn't ended yet. I think it was partly that. I think it was also, you know, it's slightly difficult to talk about, but one of my first memories is of trying to wake up one of my relatives and not being able to. And as I got older, kind of being aware there was addiction in my family. And there were lots of things I wanted to understand that I felt had never really been explained to me in the culture. I wanted to know what causes drug use and drug addiction. I wanted to know why we respond the way we do, why we imprison addicts and punish them. I wanted to know if there was a better way. One of the things that really surprised me with all the research I did for the book, you know, I traveled 30,000 miles, went to 8 different countries, was to really, almost everything we think we know about this subject is not right. Drug use is not what we think it is. Drug addiction is not what we think it is. The drug war is not driven by what we think it is. And drug legalization is not what we think it is. So it's there's a whole range of kind of mind-blowing things going on.
So who was Harry Anslinger that most people, even people who follow the U.S.'s drug war, probably have never heard of? And why did he target Billie Holiday?
Harry Anslinger is, I think, the most influential man who no one's ever heard of. I think he's an absolutely fascinating figure. He's basically the inventor of modern drug prohibition. At the end of alcohol prohibition, he was a bureaucrat and he took over the department that had been running alcohol prohibition. And obviously now we had all these demoralized guys who had nothing to do and he wanted to preserve his department. So he basically, he had previously been obsessed with, he had two really strong driving impulses, a really deep hatred of addicts based on a bad experience he had with an addict who lived near him when he was a kid, and a really deep hatred of African Americans. He was the racist who other racists at the time thought went too far. You know, people called for him to not even have his job because he'd used the N-word in official memoranda to describe people. His own senator opposed him, called for him to be fired. And for him, trying to find a purpose for this department that had nothing to do, he really latched onto these two trends that were both deep in him and deep in the culture. And Billie Holiday, to him, seemed like the perfect epitome of both of those trends. In 1939, the night she first, well, not the first night, but one of the nights she performed Strange Fruit in New York City, you know, her famous and beautiful song Against Lynching. Not long after, as her biographer Julia Blackburn explains, they warn her. The Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which is what the department had been renamed, says, you stop singing that song. And Billie Holiday absolutely refused. When she was a little girl growing up in a slum in Baltimore, the last part of the United States that didn't even have a sewage system, she made a promise to herself that she would never bow her head to any white man. And she said, you know, I'm an American citizen. I'm free to sing my song. And that was when their persecution and hounding of her really began. And I spoke to lots of her friends, and it's all her surviving friends, and and her godchildren, and it's a really kind of heartbreaking story. The first person Harry Anslinger sent to stalk her, he really hated employing African Americans, but you couldn't really send a white guy into Harlem to stalk Billie Holiday. So he employed a guy called Jimmy Fletcher, who spent 2 years tracking Billie Holiday. And Jimmy Fletcher fell in love with her. She was such an amazing person that he felt haunted the rest of his life by what he did to her. But they had her sent to prison. There was a trial. She said it was called The United States versus Billie Holiday, and that's how it felt.
So let's talk about Billie Holiday and her heroin addiction, because that is an important part of the story, not just the persecution of her. But what led to her addiction in the first place? She came from an extremely impoverished background that involved sexual abuse, prostitution at a very young age, and of course the trauma of simply growing up black and poor at a very, very racist time in the United States. How much of that contributed to her addiction to heroin, and is her story typical of why people do become addicts? Or maybe I should say maybe perhaps a slightly more extreme example.
I think you're right. There's a really important study called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study that I learned about from an amazing man I write about in the book called Dr. Gabor Mate, who's based in Vancouver. The Adverse Childhood Experiences Study looked at what happens to kids when good things and bad things happen to them. And what it found that was really extraordinary is that for every traumatic experience that happens to a child, they are 2 to 4 times more likely to grow up to be an adult injecting drug user. And you might think, well, that's extraordinary. How could that be? Basically, the best evidence, as Gabor explains it really well, is when you're a kid, you learn to soothe yourself through the way your parents treat you. So if when you get upset or angry or hurt, your parents reassure you, they calm you down, over time, you learn to do that. If when you're a kid, your parents can't do that, they're themselves disturbed or troubled or can't for circumstances beyond their control, you don't learn to do that. So if they respond to your pain and distress by being angry, you as you grow up will respond to your pain and distress by being angry. You can't soothe yourself. So you will seek things outside yourself to soothe you. This is exactly what happened to Billie Holiday. She was raped when she was 12 years old. The man who raped her was sent to prison for less time than she was. Mm-hmm. They sent her to a kind of reformatory school where she was treated horrendously with these nuns. They locked her in with a dead body overnight to punish her. I mean, you can't imagine how barbaric this was. And of course, then she goes to find her mother in Harlem, and her mother's working as a prostitute, and Billie Holiday at the age of 14 or 15 starts herself being raped for money, which is what child prostitution is. And very soon she finds the most powerful intoxicant she possibly can. And it was really heartbreaking speaking to the people she worked with, and then all over the world seeing addicts very much like her, meeting addicts very much like her from prisons in Arizona, you know, to all over the world, and realizing that these are, it helped me to think about some of the addiction in my own family as well. You know, these are people in terrible suffering and pain. And one of the really important things I discovered about drug addiction through the many scientists that I spoke to is addiction is not the earthquake, addiction is the aftershock. The earthquake is the terrible trauma and pain during childhood and adolescence or later, you know, and then you deal with it. So, and that really forces us to think differently about the drug war. If the problem is drugs, then the solution is to, if you imagine this is possible, which of course it isn't, but let's go with that for a moment, solution is to try to eradicate all the drugs in the world. If the problem actually isn't drugs, if actually the vast majority, 90% of people who use drugs have no problem with them, aren't harmed by them, and the 10% that are have this already underlying trauma and isolation, that reframes the whole thing. Well, why are we spending all this money trying to get rid of the chemical? What we have to do is spend the money helping people and supporting them. And that's not a hypothetical argument. I went to Portugal, and you might want to talk about this later, but I went to Portugal where 15 years ago, they decriminalized all drugs, right, everything, right, cannabis to crack. And they decided to spend the money instead of further traumatizing addicts, they decided to spend it on helping them get jobs, to reconnect with their feelings, to get them homes. And the results have been absolutely extraordinary. It was amazing. It was really powerful after this journey of seeing how addicts have been so abused, starting right from the story of Billie Holiday to go there.
Let's stay on the story of Billie Holiday for just a moment. I mean, she was horribly persecuted. As you say, she landed it. She was sent to prison. Did she ever give in and stop singing Strange Fruit? And did Harry Anslinger's persecution, you think, lead directly to her premature death? She died very early.
Yeah, she was in her early 40s. I think what you're asking is really important. One of the most moving interviews that was a guy called Eugene Callender, who was an incredible man. He was a reverend in Harlem who just believed it was wrong to treat people this way. When Billie Holiday collapsed, she had liver cancer and she was taken into a hospital. She was actually refused access to a hospital in New York City, and they ended up taking her to another one. And when she went there, she'd become addicted again by that point. And she went into withdrawal because she couldn't have any there. They actually arrested her on her hospital bed. They handcuffed her. They took away everything. They didn't let her friends in to see her. Eugene Callender led this protest outside the hospital with signs saying, "You're killing her. Let Lady Day live," was one of the signs. And as she was dying in the hospital, she was finally given methadone. She started to recover a little bit, and then they cut off the methadone and she died. One of her friends said, not to me, to the BBC, said she looked like she had been violently wrenched from life. But to me, the amazing thing is she kept the promise that she made to herself in that slum in Baltimore. She never bowed her head. Everywhere she went, she sang her song. She did not let them stop her. Her friend Annie Ross, the great jazz singer, said to me, "Billie Holiday was as strong as she could be." And I think that's a really important thing to remember. This story from the start of the drug war was resisted from the very start. There were really brave people all over the United States and then all over the world who saw this was crazy. Billie Holiday said, I'm paraphrasing, but said, where's the effect of, they're going to look back on this and they're going to think it's crazy. Okay.
So the history of the war on drugs today has led us to a horrendous situation on our border with Mexico and inside Mexico. Last year, there was a massive uprising as Mexicans had said they realized they just had enough when 43 students ended up missing. And you certainly couldn't write a book about the drug war without addressing what's happening in Mexico. As part of your research, you tried to find, I understand, a bona fide drug dealer, and you came upon a person named Chino Hardin. Who is Chino? How did you meet him, and how does he figure in this web of today's drug war? You describe him as, quote, a child of the drug war in the purest sense. Why?
Well, those are two separate things. So I went to Ciudad Juarez and around northern Mexico, where 60,000 people have died. And the state has basically been taken over by organized crime in particularly horrific ways. I described the story of an amazing woman whose daughter was murdered by someone from the cartels. And she tried to get justice and was herself murdered. So there's that question. Chino actually is based in New York City.
Right.
Chino is a former drug dealer, I should say. I was introduced to her by a guy from the Drug Policy Alliance. And Chino is one of the most extraordinary people I've ever met. Chino was conceived when his mother, Deborah, who was a crack addict, was raped by his father, Victor, who was an NYPD officer. So he was really conceived on one of the battlefields of the war on drugs in a very profound way. Deborah died in the first wave of the AIDS epidemic because in the United States they didn't do any harm reduction at that point. And even though huge numbers of addicts were saved in places that did do harm reduction, like Scotland, she died. And Chino became a crack dealer at the age of 13 on the corner near where they'd lived in Brownsville, and spent his childhood in and out of Rikers Island and rising up through the Bloods. And one of the amazing things to me about Chino, many amazing things about Chino, it's one of the most articulate people I know, and I interviewed him over 3 years, Chino, when he was in his early 20s, comes out of Rikers and starts to learn about the drug war and just realizes, oh my God, none of this didn't have to happen. It didn't have to be this way. My life didn't have to be this way. You know, his mother didn't have to die like that, and became an extremely articulate opponent of the war on drugs, and went back and led a campaign to shut down the first prison that he was detained in, the one when he was detained when he was 13, called Spafford, which no longer exists. You know, he's an amazing person.
And so in Mexico, and thank you for that clarification, in Mexico on the drug, on the border with the United States, we currently have a situation where the supplies of drugs are coming in, turning into eventually passing through many hands, ending up in the hands of people, of drug dealers like Chino Hardin once was. And we have a situation that on the other side of the border is fueling this massive crisis, fueling murders that we don't seem to be here in the United States, at least those of us who don't have relatives back in Mexico don't seem to be touched by. But this is a huge part of the war on drugs. How is this something that is not treated as a huge part of the war on drugs by the powers that be?
It's worse than that. Michelle Leonhardt, the head of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, described the fact that 60,000 people have died in the last, 7 years, as, these were her words, a sign of success in the war on drugs. That should be a national and international scandal. one of the ways that I really got to understand what's happened in northern Mexico is I interviewed a guy called Rosario Retta. He's the only person to ever be at the heart of the worst Mexican drug cartel, the Zetas, and make it out and live to speak. He's in prison in Tyler County in Texas. And he was recruited. He actually grew up in Laredo, just on the border. So it's basically, you've got Laredo and Nuevo Laredo, and they're basically the same place divided by the border. And he would kind of cross over, and he was recruited at the age of 13, killed, best estimate is about 70 people by the time he was 17. And the thing that struck me about it is how much the cartels have taken over the Mexican state. If you transfer a hugely popular substance to... If you ban a hugely popular substance, it doesn't go away. It gets transferred to armed criminal gangs. Now, if you look at how bad that is, even in a place like where you think about, you know, Brownsville, where, you know, the illegal drug trade may be like 10-15%, you look at that's enough to make Brownsville a horrible place to be. We're talking about Ciudad Juarez. 70% of the economy is made up of, you know, these kind of cartels. It really struck me when I first went there. One of the guy who was my guide, Julian Cardona, who's a brilliant, he's the Reuters correspondent for Juarez. I wanted to meet, obviously, victims of the drug war, and he kept taking me to meet people who've been killed by the police. And I said, oh, you know, Julian, this is an important part of the story, but I need to meet people who've been killed by the cartels. And he said, oh, yeah, you don't understand. When the cartels want to kill someone, they pay the police to do it. These aren't separate forces.
Right.
And that was the point where I thought, wow, okay. That's where we try to imagine if the LAPD was run by the Crips and the Bloods. You know, that's when you get some sense of what's happened to Mexico. And, you know, unless you reclaim that trade, look, Chicago, during alcohol prohibition, you know, if you transfer a popular trade to armed criminal gangs, they will kill each other in increasingly theatrical and awful ways until you legalize that substance. You provide a legal route to the market. When you do that, what happens? They go away.
Right.
You know,
right.
Actually, they return to Chicago when drug prohibition becomes a massive thing again.
And actually, Johan, that is another very interesting and unique thing about the drug trade that I learned from your book, which is, and police know this, you write, that, for example, if you arrest a lot of rapists, you usually tend to have the incidence of rape going down. But if you arrest a lot of drug dealers, violence goes up because of the turf war that ensues when you take one person out of the system. You get a turf war to figure out who's going to fill that. And so that crucial fact that you cannot fight this drug war using law enforcement and arrests, police know this, and that leads me to my question about Lee Maddox, the former police officer whom you interviewed for your book, that she's now a member of the group Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. This is a very interesting character as well. What motivated Lee Maddox to join LEAP and give up being a cop? Actually, what even motivated her to become a cop in the first place?
I love Lee Maddox. She's an extraordinary person. I interviewed, I think it was 12 or 13 former cops who come out against the drug war. And Lee is really an extraordinary person. Lee could not have been a truer believer in the war on drugs. She signed up because her best friend Lisa was murdered by what she believed was a drug gang. And she signed up because she wanted to destroy these people. She wanted to destroy the people who'd murdered her best friend. And she really believed in this stuff, and she really went to war against these people in Maryland. And what she noticed was exactly what you say. You arrest a drug dealer, no one thinks there's fewer drugs available the next day. If you arrest a drug dealer, there's loads queuing up to do it. But what does happen is you have a turf war, you have a shootout, because someone's going to control the patch. And previously someone had established dominance, now they've lost it. Okay, we'll have a fight. You see that dynamic everywhere in the drug war. So Lee noticed that. She actually noticed that it empowers the drug gangs. The drug gangs exist because of the war on drugs. And then another of her closest friends, a fellow police officer, a very brave undercover officer called Ed Totley, was killed. So she's now lost her two best friends in this, you know, completely futile way. And Lee started to look at the evidence. And now Lee does, I mean, such heroic work. Lee now tries to undo what she did as a police officer. She works in Baltimore trying to get the criminal records expunged of people who were arrested for drug offenses and whose lives were just ruined. And I think, to me, some of the most articulate exponents of why we need to end the drug war are the people who've fought it and believe in it and have seen what happens when you try to.
So, Johan, let's talk about what needs to happen? You brought up Portugal earlier, a country that has completely decriminalized all drugs, and many proponents of legalization look at it as a sort of silver bullet. And, you know, if we could only legalize drugs, then this drug war would be over and we would see things improve. Of course, addicts, this doesn't address why people get addicted in the first place. Maybe a larger conversation on poverty is more relevant here. But how do we look at drug legalization? Is it really the sort of antidote, or is that too simplistic?
We've got to distinguish between decriminalization and legalization. Okay. Decriminalization is where you don't punish people for using drugs. Legalization is where you provide a legitimate avenue to buying them. So Portugal is decriminalized but not legalized. So if you use drugs, they won't punish you. If you sell drugs, they will. So it's a kind of hypocrisy, but it's a significant advance from where we are. What happened in Portugal, I went to lots of places that have tried alternatives like Switzerland and Portugal. The most important thing is by the year 2000, Portugal had 1% of its population addicted to heroin, which is crazy. And they'd tried the prohibitionist way and it didn't work. So what happened is the main political parties got together and did something really clever. They basically said, we're going to appoint a scientific commission of doctors and judges and a couple of social scientists, I think. And we're going to agree in advance that whatever they recommend, we'll do it. I don't think they thought they would recommend something quite as radical, but, you know, to their credit, they stuck to it. And the crucial thing is not just decriminalization, although that was important, it was the transfer of resources. What Dr. Juan Gulao, the amazing man who led this, told me about, is basically the key thing was they took all the money they used to spend on arresting drug addicts, imprisoning drug addicts,
out of time if you could wrap.
Sure. They basically completely transferred that to really compassionate care, reconnecting addicts with society, reconnecting them with their feelings, and getting them jobs. And the results have been incredible. There's been a 50% fall in injecting drug use. Well, one of the most important things for John Sun is the alternatives work incredibly well.
Johan Hari, I want to thank you so much for joining us today to discuss your book, Chasing the Screen, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. Johan Hari is an award-winning journalist and author, and his 2015 book, Chasing the Screen, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs, formed the basis for the new film, The United States versus Billie Holiday, out now on Hulu. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.